Hi, so welcome back to donations. As discussed, we know now that a donor is not going to be able to do just whatever he or she wants with his or her property because there's certain limitations that the law places on a donor as to what they can do with their property. So the first limit we've talked about was forced heirship. So we've now wrapped that up. So what we've got to do today is we have to talk about the second and third limitation on a donor as to what they can and can't do with their property. Okay, so the second limitation that we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about is condition. Now, you probably remember from earlier in the semester, we have learned that a donation can have a condition attached to it. So there's nothing wrong with just having a condition per se. We've also learned a little bit about conditions already. If you remember, Article 1530 taught us that a condition cannot rest solely with the donor or the donor's will, that that is an unacceptable thing. We've also seen that a donation can't be conditioned on a donee having to pay certain debts or charges that don't yet exist unless that's expressed in the act of donation itself, and that's from Article 1531. So we've already seen conditions crop up, you know, once in a while in our discussions. But today we're going to really zero in and try to figure out what is okay when it comes to conditions and what is not allowed. So the idea that we're going to be looking at can be found in Article 1519. Article 1519 says this: in all dispositions, inter vivos, and mortis causa, impossible conditions, those which are contrary to the laws or to morals, are reputed, not written. So what's that mean? Well, basically exactly what it says, and just FYI, Article 1528 in the code, in the section on donations inter vivos in particular, sort of echoes that same exact sentiment that we see in 1519 that applies equally to both donation inter vivos and mortis causa. So what both of those articles are essentially saying is that if a donation has a condition attached to it, that's fine. But if that condition is either impossible, illegal, or immoral, that is not going to be okay. Now, we're going to learn at the, you know, at the end of this discussion about this limit what happens if you do have a condition like that. But for right now, just keep in mind impossible, illegal, and immoral conditions are not going to be okay. So let's kind of identify what we mean when we say impossible, illegal, immoral condition. All right. So the first thing, I guess, to discuss is the idea of impossible conditions. Now, you probably remember this notion of impossibility popping up in your obligations class. If you look at Article 1972, that's in the articles on obligations, but it applies here as well. It says that a contractual object is possible or impossible according to its own nature and not according to the party's ability to perform. So when we're talking about an impossible condition, we're talking about something that no one in the world essentially would be able to do. Now, that's not the condition that tends to pop up most often in our cases. We tend to see the conditions dealing more with this illegal or immoral type of nature. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a few of the cases that were assigned to kind of get a feel for what exactly it is we're looking for. So the first case that I want us to talk about is LaBarre versus Hopkins. This is a Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1855, so rather old. It's on page 13-10 of your book. So in the LaBarre case, we basically had a lady, Miss Hopkins, who died. And since we're in donations, you can probably figure out she died testate. And she left behind separate property. Now, basically, she had in her will a usufruct. And in that usufruct, she left it to her husband and said, you know, you get this usufruct, but it's going to terminate upon your remarriage. So, you know, first things first, can someone leave a usufruct in a will? Sure, we've talked about that already. Article 1499 says that, and we even know now that a usufruct in favor of a surviving spouse wouldn't be an impingement on the forester's legitime. Not that that's an issue here, but just as a way or, by way of reminder. So, yeah, it's fine to leave a usufruct in a will. The second kind of question that you may be asking is, can Ms. Hopkins leave or put a condition on that usufruct? Of course, conditions in general, like I've told you guys, are totally fine. So what is the issue with the condition at issue in this case? Well, Mr. Hopkins argues that the condition in question is contrary to good morals. He says that by leaving him a usufruct that will terminate upon his remarriage, but that's against good morals because that is basically in restraint of marriage. Now, of course, he's making that argument. He wants that condition to be struck out because he has, in fact, remarried. So if, you know, if he is right that this condition is in restraint of marriage and that that would make it contrary to good morals, then what will happen is they're going to cross the condition out, but the donation is going to go through to him. So he has a strong interest in having this condition struck. If he is wrong, then basically what is going to happen is he's going to be seen to have now violated the condition and his usufruct is going to terminate, which is going to be bad news for him. So what does the court say? Is he right? Is this condition that the usufruct is going to terminate on remarriage, is it in restraint of marriage such that it's contrary to good morals? Well, the court says no. The court says, you know, second marriages are not exactly special favorites in Louisiana law. The court does acknowledge that a prohibition against marriage would generally be against public policy. So if I said, you know, you get this on the condition that you never get married, well, that's not going to be legit under Louisiana law because that's prohibiting you from getting married. That's against public policy. But the prohibition of a subsequent marriage, the court says, is not going to be against public policy. So that's one issue that tends to come up in the cases is the marriage issue. So, again, a prohibition against ever getting married generally would be against public policy, but not a condition that will terminate a usufruct upon a second marriage. So the next case also dealt with marital status, and that is the case of Session of Ruxton. Now, this is a Louisiana Supreme Court opinion from 1955. It's on page 13-11 of your book. In this case, we have a man who dies, and his name is William Ruxton, and he dies testate again. He leaves a provision in his will that says that he's going to leave $10,000 to Virginia Brookshire if she's still unmarried at his death. Now, if she is, in fact, married, the $10,000 is going to go back into his estate and be disposed with according to other provisions in the testament. Now, of course, the reason we read this case and the reason it's in your book is because her marital status at the death of William is she's married, okay? So she's going to make the argument, of course, that, oh, this provision has a condition attached to it, which we know is totally fine. But she's going to say this condition is against public policy because it is in restraint of marriage. The court rules that this condition is fine. The court says that, you know, this isn't a lifetime prohibition on getting married. It's not saying you can never get married. And in fact, there's no deterrent effect at all because Virginia didn't even know about this provision in the will until William died anyway. And the court goes on to say, you know, even if a prohibition upon a legatee remaining unmarried is against public policy, this legacy is fixed in time. You know, it discusses her marital status at his death, not that she's going to stay unmarried forever. So basically, the legacy is not forbidding her from marrying, and it's not even saying that if she later gets married that the legacy will lapse. What it's saying is this is a condition on her marital status at the moment of his death. And the court rules in succession of Ruxton that that is perfectly allowable. Now, things get even more interesting with the case of succession of Augustus. This is a Fourth Circuit opinion from 1978. It's on page 13-12 of your book. In this case, we had a lady named Hattie Simon who dies testate. Now, in her will, she left her husband, a guy named Leonard, a usufruct over her separate property. Again, leaving a usufruct is fine, particularly to a spouse. You can do that in your will under Article 1499 again. Now, what she said, though, in this will was you get the usufruct for your lifetime. Hey, that would be fine under 1499 too. And it goes on to say, though, and to terminate only upon his death or in the event he allows Thelma Poynton Augustus or Cecile Heal to enter this house. All right, so I guess we kind of have to back up and talk about who Thelma Poynton Augustus is. All right, Leonard had been dating, living with Hattie, our decedent, for like 9 years. And he ended up leaving Hattie for this Thelma woman. He ended up marrying Thelma, but then he ended up leaving her to live back with Hattie. So Leonard is back and forth between Hattie and Thelma. So he lives with Hattie for 9 years. He leaves her for Thelma. He marries Thelma. Then he leaves Thelma and goes back to Hattie. And somewhere along the way, maybe 14 years after he comes back to Hattie, Hattie writes the will in question. Eventually, 8 years later, Leonard ends up divorcing Thelma, marrying Hattie, and then he and Hattie are together until Hattie dies. But then, you know, Leonard just can't stay away from Thelma because 2 years after Hattie dies, there's Leonard back with Thelma. So you have basically a lifetime of a man flip-flopping back and forth between two women, and you can imagine that Hattie's not real happy with this whole scenario. So she puts this provision in her will that he's going to get the usufruct over her separate property, but he can never bring Thelma into that house. So Leonard then is going to make the argument that this condition that, you know, his usufruct will terminate upon him bringing Hattie back into the house, I'm sorry, bringing Thelma back into the house, is against public policy because he says this restricts my right to remarry. Court says, nah, this condition's fine. This condition doesn't place any limitation on your right to remarry. Hattie didn't say a word about the usufruct terminating upon your remarriage. In fact, all she said was you can't bring Thelma into what was Hattie's separate property house. So basically the court declares that that condition is going to be fine in this case. And remember, again, you know, bequest of a usufruct that terminates upon a second marriage wouldn't be against public policy anyway against the earlier cases that we discussed. So you can see that marital status and remarriage and things like that tend to kind of pop up through some of the case law. Something different that is presented in another case, succession of Fitel, which is on page 13-13 of your book. This is a Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1933. Now, this doesn't deal with a condition related to marital status or anything like that. In this case, we had a lady who died named Jasmine. She died testate, and in her will, she left a piece of land to Hannah Bodenheimer and her son, but Jasmine provides that those people cannot sell or mortgage the property in question for 10 years after death, okay? So there are a couple of issues going on in this case, but the one that we're really going to focus on is whether or not that condition is valid or not. So the condition says you can't sell or mortgage the property for a period of 10 years, basically. So the court in this case decided that that condition was invalid. So what they're going to end up doing, and we're going to kind of talk about this in just a second, is they're going to read out the condition. So basically where it says the land is going to go to Hannah and her son, but you can't sell it or mortgage it for 10 years. They're going to just essentially strike out the part that says, but you can't sell it or mortgage it for 10 years. So what's left is, oh, here, the land goes to Hannah and her son. So the donation goes through, but the condition is read out. Now, the reason that the court finds this condition to be invalid is that Jasmine bequeaths the property to Hannah and her son in full ownership. So basically, when you do that, when you're transferring ownership of someone, you give them all the rights to that property. I mean, they have the right to use it, abuse it. They are entitled to the fruits. Once you transfer property, it leaves your patrimony and goes into someone else's. And so you don't have any right to tell that person what they can and can't do with regard to that property. That kind of flies in the face of what ownership is. So in this case, you know, this provision that says you can't sell it, you can't mortgage it for 10 years, that is sort of against the notion of ownership and loss of dominion of one in favor of the other who's supposed to be getting full ownership. So basically a testator cannot sort of impose on the donee the condition about not selling and not mortgaging that property. I mean, and also this kind of raises another interesting policy implication that generally our Louisiana law is going to kind of be opposed to this notion of dead hand control. So if we allow Jasmine from the grave to say what can and can't be done with this property, that's dead hand control, and that's essentially not a good thing. Now, of course, we do have trust law in Louisiana that will allow for that to a certain degree, but our general civil code law says we're not going to have that. So we're not going to tie up estate. We're not going to restrain alienation from the grave. So that was found to be a condition that is invalid as violative of Article 15.19. Now, another thing that you kind of need to be on the lookout for in this whole area of conditions is something that we call a penal clause. This is basically a clause that is put into a will that's kind of supposed to be like a punishment. So basically what it'll say is something to the effect of, like, I give my such and such property to A. And then it mentions other property that's going to be going to other people like B, C, D, whatever. And there'll be a clause in the will that says something to the effect of, like, okay, A, if you challenge any of my other donations to B, C, or D, or if you challenge my will maybe, then you don't get your donation. Generally, whether or not those things are valid or not depends on what the donor is trying to keep the donee from doing. Okay, so for example, let's say that the donor says, I give my land to A, but A is a foreseer. And then the donor says, and I give all the rest of my property to B. And A, if you challenge this donation to B at all, you don't get anything. Well, let's say that the land that the testator left to A was not enough to satisfy A, who's a foreseer's legitime. So basically what the testator is saying to A is, yeah, you're a foreseer. Yeah, I didn't leave you enough to satisfy your legitime. But if you go challenge that, if you bring an action for reduction, basically, then you don't get anything. Well, in that situation, the right to bring an action for reduction is a rule of public order. And so a court's going to say, we're not going to uphold that penal clause. So if it's something like that, if it has to do with forced heirship and reduction or collation or something like that, then the penal clause is going to be invalid, and the court's definitely not going to pay attention to that. However, if what the penal clause is trying to keep the donee from doing via a challenge is not against public order, then the clause would be valid. So, you know, if the testator said, I leave my property, this piece of land to A, I'll leave the rest of my property to B. A is not a forcer, throw that out of the picture. A, if you try to challenge my capacity to this will, you get nothing. In that situation, the clause would be considered valid. Now, the last thing we need to talk about when it comes to conditions is something I've already alluded to, really, and that is what happens in the event that a donor does put an illegal, impossible, or immoral condition on a donation. Well, Article 1519 says that in that situation, the condition is reputed, not written. So as a general rule, again, I've said this already, but the condition is null. It's absolutely null. It's going to be read out, but the donation itself is going to go through. Now, there is a case, though, that kind of gives us an exception to that rule. It's the succession of Thompson case. It's on page 13-8 of your book. It's a 1909 case from the Louisiana Supreme Court. In the Thompson case, a guy named Edward Thompson died testate. He left the forced portion to his forced heir. He left the disposable portion to Fink Asylum. Now, Fink Asylum was a home that had been established through this guy Fink's will, and the home was for Protestant widows and orphans. Now, when Thompson left the disposable portion to Fink Asylum, he put a condition on it. He said, in order to get this legacy, you, Fink Asylum, must furnish a room and support for my daughters if they're ever homeless. Now, the problem is that Thompson's daughters would never get a room or shelter or support from Fink Asylum because they wouldn't qualify because they weren't widows or orphans. So you've got basically an impossible condition here. Now, the trustee for Fink Asylum was the city of New Orleans, and they're like, yeah, you know, this is an impossible condition, so the condition should be considered not written, we should read it out, and the donation should go through. Now, the question is, what do we do with the condition? Fink Asylum's going, wait a minute, look, hey, look, give us some money. We will comply with the condition, no problem. If something happens to one of these three daughters where they're homeless, we'll take them in. Well, the court's like, no, Fink Asylum, we can't really let you do that. Because if we're letting you do that, now you're violating the whole purpose of Fink's will. Fink had set up this institution, gave money to have it built, saying it can only be for the benefit of Protestant widows and orphans. Well, that's not what Thompson's daughters were. So we cannot let you just agree to the condition in Thompson's will because then you'll be violating a condition in Fink's will. They're like, we can't do that. So basically what the court said was, all right, yes, as a general rule, we are going to read out the condition and let the donation go through. But they kind of come up with an exception, and they say, you know, if the condition is the prime or moving cause for making the legacy, without which the legacy would not have been made, then we're going to read out the entire legacy altogether. And so basically the court decided in this case that's exactly what happened. The whole purpose behind Edward Thompson leaving that money to Fink Asylum was to provide for his daughters. And because that couldn't be done, that was impossible under the law and under Fink's will, you know, the court couldn't reconcile Thompson's will with Fink's will. And so they're like, you know, Thompson's condition is impossible. And furthermore, we're not going to just read the condition out and give the money or the legacy to Fink Asylum because that condition was the sole motivating factor for why Thompson made the legacy in the first place. So we're going to delete the entire legacy in that situation. So that essentially wraps up our discussion of the first condition of the day. I'm sorry, let me back up. That wraps up our discussion of the second limitation, the first one we discussed today, on a donor's power to do what he wants, and that is the donor cannot place certain conditions, illegal, immoral, or impossible ones, on his donations. Now, actually, that doesn't wrap it up. This is a hot mess. I'm sorry. The hypos. So, the hypos that we have start with hypo 54, and that hypo says, a man, George, has a beautiful daughter, Rihanna, to whom young men flock. George gives Rihanna $100,000 on the condition that she never marry. Is that condition valid? Why or why not? No, that condition is not valid. Under the rationale of Ruxton and under Article 1519, conditions to never marry would be against public policy. Hypo 55 says that same situation, but now Rihanna's not so attractive. She's old. She does not have and has never had a boyfriend. She's poor. And George really is doing this to ensure that Rihanna is cared for should something happen to him. So he executes a testament in which he leaves Rihanna $100,000 more than he leaves his son Chris, who's got a bunch of money. George writes in the testament that the $100,000 extra is conditioned on Rihanna still being unmarried 5 years after his death. Is this condition valid? Yeah. In this situation, this is really similar to one of the cases where the condition is really based on her status at a specific period in time. It is the period of time is the 5 years after his death. And so we think that that would be fine. I would also note that, you know, we've not seen a Louisiana case dealing with or discussing this, but in this hypo, George has pure motivation. He's not doing this to keep Rihanna necessarily from getting married. He's doing it to take care of her. In some foreign civil law jurisdictions, that would make a big difference. Like I said, in Louisiana, we've never really seen that issue even brought up in the case law. So we don't know that it would really make that much of a difference, but it is something to think about. But really, the fact that the condition hinges on status at a specific time should make it okay. Hypo 56 says Renald, a devout Catholic, has a daughter named Mary who is engaged to Joseph. Renald is worried that Joseph does not take marriage as seriously as does Mary and that Joseph would support a person's right to divorce. Renald donates $100,000 worth of stock to Joseph on the condition that the stock will revert back to Renald should Joseph ever divorce Mary. Is the condition valid? Why or why not? I can tell you that the answer to this is somewhat uncertain. I mean, obviously, right to marry is something that Louisiana courts take very seriously. However, right to divorce might not necessarily be the same thing. Now, look, in France, the French believe that the right to divorce is equivalent to the right to marry, and that no one should be able to interfere with someone else's right to get a divorce. But in Louisiana, you know, we are traditionally not super supportive of divorce like we are marriage. Of course, you know, in recent times, our divorce law has been seriously liberalized, so we really just don't know the answer to that hypothetical. Hypo 57 says, in a testament, Heidi's father leaves Heidi a farm on the condition she not sell it for 5 years after his death. Is this condition valid? Why or why not? Of course, this is sort of similar to the Vitale case, and in that case, we saw that the 10 years was too long. Here we have a five-year period. Now, that is shorter, and I can tell you that the longer the condition goes on, the more likely it would be invalid. We really are not 100% sure about this case because it's not identical to Vitale. I mean, logically speaking, the rationale of Vitale would hold here, that if you're truly leaving property to someone, it should be theirs to do with as they wish. We can also make, I guess, an economic argument that we want to keep property in commerce. And so we wouldn't like this condition for that reason. And then again, that whole moral argument of we don't like dead hand control. But ultimately, this one is not 100% sure answer. Hypo 58 says that Heidi's father leaves his farm in equal shares to Heidi and her two sisters on the condition the three girls never partition it, keep it together forever. Is this a valid condition? Why or why not? No. In this situation, Articles 1297, 1299 basically say that you cannot have a stipulation by a donor or by the parties to never partition a piece of property. Hypo 59 says same thing, but now Heidi's father wants the girls to keep the farm together for 20 years. Is this valid? Generally speaking, no, especially if the co-heirs are having some disputes about what to do with the property. The code articles talk about holding the property together in this situation for 5 years, but 20 years would be too long under the code articles and then also under, like, FITEL. Hypo 60 says, same thing, but now the girls are 12, 14, and 16, and the father conditions the donation on the girls not partitioning it until they reach majority. Is that a valid condition? If you look at the code articles, it basically says that he can require they not partition it, but only until one reaches majority. So once the oldest one turns 18, then the condition is basically done. You can't hold that condition until they're all 18. And then finally, Jenny has a son, Evan, who is profoundly autistic, and she leaves Evan a usufruct over all her property and naked ownership to her boyfriend, Jim. And she says that if Evan or his representative seek to reduce the legacy to Jim, Evan shall have nothing. Is this clause valid? No, this is a penal clause, and what it's dealing with is reduction rights of a forced heir, which, again, is a public order sort of right. And so, therefore, because Evan is a forced heir due to his disability, she can't leave the usufruct to Jim in the first place. Remember back to what we talked about, that the ledge team has to be in full ownership. And then she cannot tell Evan that he can't challenge the donation to Jim via an action for reduction, because that would violate the rules on penal clauses. All right, so now we've actually truly finished a discussion about illegal, immoral, impossible conditions. And that leads us to our discussion of the third and final limit on the donor's ability to do what he wants with his property. And this is the notion that a donor cannot have what's called a prohibited substitution. Now, let me start by saying that not all substitutions are prohibited. It has to be something that falls into the definition of a prohibited substitution under Article 1520. So what does Article 1520 say? Article 1520 says a disposition that is not in trust, by which a thing is donated in full ownership to a first donee called the institute, with a charge to preserve the thing and deliver it to a second donee called the substitute, at the death of the institute, is null with regard to both the institute and the substitute. All right, so basically, we're going to go through this in great detail in a second, but what we're saying in essence in 1520 is that a donor cannot donate something to one person and then tell that person, oh, you've got to take care of this thing and then turn it over to somebody else when you die. All right, so for example, if I said a classic prohibited substitution would be, let's say I die and in my will I write, I give my car to X, and upon his death, X must take care of my car, and upon his death, X must then deliver that car to Y. That's a classic prohibited substitution. So you're looking for, basically, in your fact pattern, you're looking for, like, three different people. If you don't have three people in the fact pattern, you don't have to worry about a prohibited substitution, but you're looking for a donor and then two different donees, the first one, again, called the institute, and the second one called the substitute. So what are the elements to a prohibited substitution? Well, according to 1520, there are several. So the first thing Article 1520 said, if you recall, is it said a disposition that is not in trust. All right, if you have a trust in the picture, you're going to have to go look at the trust code and figure out if the trust code allows for the type of substitution in place in this transaction. Now, we'll learn all the rules on trust later, but for right now, just know if you see a trust, you should not be thinking prohibited substitution under Article 1520. All right, so you're looking for something not in trust. Then you're looking for something to be donated in full ownership to one person, and then the same thing to be going in full ownership to someone else. Now, there's more to it than that, but let's just kind of focus on that second thing. So we said not in trust is the first element. The second element is you're looking for a double liberality. You're looking for your donor to give the same thing in full ownership to one person, and then that same thing is going to kick over in full ownership to another person. All right, so easy example. Let's say I have a double liberality, not a prohibited substitution. We're just focusing on the double liberality thing. So if I say I give my library to X, and then when X graduates from law school, X has to give the library to Y. All right. This is definitely a double liberality, right? Because the same thing, the library, is being given in full ownership first by me to X, and then I'm essentially telling X, you can't do what you want with the property. Instead, no, you've got to preserve it and render it to somebody else. That's Y. Now, of course, this is not a prohibited substitution. As we're going to discuss a little bit later, one of the elements in a prohibited substitution is the transfer from the first donee to the second donee has to happen on death. Now, in my hypo, the transfer occurs upon graduation from law school. That would not be a prohibited substitution, but I was just using the hypo to illustrate the concept of double liberality. So you're giving one thing in full ownership to one person and then giving the exact same thing in full ownership to another person. Let's look at another hypo. This one is a little bit tougher. It says, I'm going to give my house to X and Y, equal shares, and whenever the first of them die, the one that's still living is going to get the whole thing. Now, in other states, if you're a common law student, you might know what this is. In other states, it's called a joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. Now, are we having a double liberality going on? Well, think about this for a second. We're giving X and Y equal shares of a piece of property, right? But we're saying whichever one dies first, his half is then going to kick over to the other one who's still alive. Well, this would be a double liberality. How, you say? Well, what's being conveyed would be the half ownership of whoever dies first. So let's say that X died first. So I left my house to X and Y, half to X, half to Y. Well, if X dies first, then that same half is being owned first by X, and then per the terms of my will, it's then going to be owned in full ownership by Y. And so that would be a double liberality. That would be an issue that you would want to be on the lookout for. All right. Now, if I did something like this, if I said, I leave my house to John and Jill. Now, this is very similar to the last hypo where I said, I leave my house to X and Y. But if I just say, I leave my house to John and Jill, I am differentiating from the last hypo somewhat. Because in the last one, remember, I also said, okay, I'm leaving it half and half to X and Y, and whichever one dies first, then their share will kick over to the one who's still alive. In this hypo, I've not done that. I've just said, I leave my property half to John, half to Jill. That's not a double liberality, right? So basically, you can have a couple things happen under this FIPO. Let's say, for example, I left my property, my house, John and Jill, half and half. Let's say John predeceased me. Well, in that situation, John sharing the property would accrete to someone. Maybe it would be Jill, maybe it wouldn't be, but it wouldn't be under my will as to how it would accrete. So you wouldn't have John's share going on John's death to someone else, say, in the future, okay? So if John predeceases me, his interest in the legacy is going to lapse, and there will be rules that we'll learn later in the semester on what will happen in that situation. But basically, you know, if John were to predecease me, well, it's not like there's any portion of it going to John and then Jill per the terms of my will, okay? Now, if something were to happen to John, say, after I died, well, John's half would be vested in him, and he could do whatever he wanted with that property upon his death, or he could die intestate, and it could go via intestate law, as you learn in succession law. But basically, in that hypo with John and Jill, I mean, basically, you're never going to have one of them own it in full, and then the other one. They're either, you know, both going to own it sort of together, or one or the other will, but you're not going to have any portion of it going from one then to the other under the terms of, say, my will. All right. And look, I mean, what if I left it to John and Jill half and half, and then John ends up dying later, and in his will he says, I leave my half to Jill. That's perfectly fine. That's not a prohibited substitution. That's not a double liberality because I didn't leave the same thing in full ownership to one person and then to another. So that scenario, not a double liberality. That's something called a joint legacy. We're going to learn all about that later in the semester. Something else that you need to be on the lookout for is illustrated in the cases of Thilborger and Fornay. So in Thilborger, this is on page 13-33 of your book. This is a Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1958. He had a woman named Louise Thilborger who is going to die testate. And in her will, she has a provision that says, I give, devise, and bequeath the use of certain property to her husband Edward as long as he lives and at death to be given to charity hospital, da 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 da. So the question is, does that provision constitute a prohibited substitution? Louisiana Supreme Court said no. They point out that the words are going to be pretty important, and what Louise left her husband, Edward, in that will was the use of the property. So when you leave someone the use of the property, what you're leaving him or her is essentially a usufruct. So that means that Edward, the husband, got the usufruct over her property, and the naked ownership belonged to Charity Hospital. So you didn't have the same thing going first in full ownership to Edward and then upon his death in full ownership to Charity. Instead, from the get-go, Louise split the ownership right. So she gave Edward the usufruct. She gave Charity Hospital the naked ownership. So when Edward dies, his usufruct rights would essentially merge with the naked ownership rights that Charity had all along. And so upon his death, now Charity is the full owner. But Edward was never the full owner. So you don't have a double liberality. You're not giving the same thing in full ownership to one and then the other. You're giving the usufruct to one, the husband, and something different, the naked ownership, to the other, Charity Hospital. So watch for cases with split ownership because in that scenario, that is not going to be seen as a double liberality or, you know, a prohibited substitution. So that's Thilborger. Another case that dealt with a similar scenario is Fornay. That's a Third Circuit opinion from 1967, and it's on page 13-37. In the Fornay case, Blanche Fornay dies testate. And she has a provision in her will
by which she leaves her daughter named Beulah a lifetime usufruct. And then she says when Beulah dies, a lifetime usufruct over the same property to another one of her daughters, Maydell. And then the rest of her property gets left to all of her kids. She had like four. So the issue, of course, is that provision from Blanche to Beulah and then to Maydell on Beulah's death, is that a prohibited substitution? The court, the Third Circuit, says no. What we have going on here is a little different from Stillborder. Remember, Stillborder dealt with naked ownership to one, usufruct to the other. This provision deals with successive usufruct. So a lifetime usufruct to Beulah, then a lifetime usufruct to Maydell. And the court says that is not a substitution. Both usufructuaries are taking directly from the decedent, and they're successive usufruct, and that is perfectly fine under Louisiana law. So be on the lookout for split ownership. Those are fine. Be on the lookout for joint legacies. Those are fine. Something else that you need to be on the lookout for is something that is raised in Batten. Batten versus Taylor is a Louisiana Supreme Court case from 1979. It's an important case for a lot of reasons. It's on page 13-25 of your book. We are looking at it for an analysis of prohibited substitutions. Now, we have a guy named Gordon Batten who dies. By the way, he died domiciled in Texas, but he left separate and movable property in Louisiana, which means Louisiana law is going to apply if you're just kind of wondering from a conflict perspective. Now, Gordon Batten left behind a will, and in it he left to his wife, Floyd, his property. And he says, provided she be living when I die and live for 30 days thereafter, and if not, then I want my property to go to my nephew. All right, so we got a weird kind of situation going on here. You've got basically Gordon Batten saying, you get it, Floyd, wife, as long as you're still alive and you outlive me by 30 days, but if not, then it goes to my nephew. Now, Floyd did survive him for 30 days. So the question is this a prohibited substitution? The court said no. This is not a prohibited substitution. What this is a double conditional gift, or we might also phrase it as a vulgar substitution. Those are fine, the court says. So the reason that the court characterizes it as a double condition on the gift, the court says, look, let's look at it kind of in two pieces. You have a legacy to Floyd, the wife. There's a condition attached to that. It's a suspensive condition saying you only get this, Floyd, if you outlive me past 30 days. That's fine to have a suspensive condition attached to a legacy. And the court says, now let's look at the other sort of alternative legacy to the nephews. That legacy also has a suspensive condition. It says, nephews, you get my property if Floyd doesn't survive me by 30 days. So it has a suspensive condition attached to it. So the court says, hey, look, double conditional gifts, these are fine. We are going to be perfectly fine with that. And by the way, in that case, there was a 30-day survivorship clause. Just FYI, under Louisiana law now, it has been codified that that's fine to do that. And also that the period of time the survivorship clause can run for is maximum 6 months. So you do need to be aware of that. The bar examiner will throw that at you on occasion, 6 months max on a survivorship clause. This whole notion of vulgar substitution, double conditional gifts, where you're saying, oh, I'm going to give it to so-and-so, but, you know, if they don't outlive me or take it. Or if they won't take it, then I want my property to go to someone else. That's perfectly fine. So be aware you're looking for a double liberality. Same thing, full ownership, one person, then the next. Not joint legacies, not split ownership, not vulgar substitutions, not double conditional gifts. All of those things are fine. So just kind of be on the lookout for all of that. And, I mean, furthermore, the other requirements of a prohibited substitution weren't satisfied either, but we're really looking at Batten for purposes of whether or not what the decedent did in that case constituted a double liberality? And the answer, of course, like I said, is no. So first requirement, prohibited substitution, it's not placed in trust. Second, it has to be a double liberality. Kind of along that same line, let's look at a couple of hypos, and let's see if we can kind of play with this notion of double liberality a little bit more. So the first hypo that you have here is hypo 63. Hypo 63 says, by testament, Eddie leaves to Leanne $100,000 for her sole use and benefit without security during her natural life. At her death, it is to be divided and given equally to his children, Mason and Jake. He dies. Leanne files for probate. Mason and Jake, through their tutor, challenge the legacy, saying it is a prohibited substitution. I asked, is it? Is it a double liberality? Why or why not? No, it is not a double liberality, so therefore it's not a prohibited substitution. By the language of his legacy, kind of along the lines of Spielberger, what Eddie has done is essentially given Leanne a usufruct. So giving a usufruct to one would then entail or entitle the others to naked ownership, and that's split ownership. And under Spielberger, that is not a double liberality and therefore not a prohibited substitution. The next hypo is 64, and it says that Eddie leaves his watch to his son Mason, but he says if Mason can't or won't take it, then Jake is going to get it. Is that a prohibited substitution? The answer is no. That's a vulgar substitution, which, again, is fine. You don't have a double liberality here. You're not going to have one person own it fully and then at their death have to transfer it to another person. Instead, either Mason or Jake is going to be the only one to receive the watch. It's not going to be given to one and then to the other. So basically, it's going to go to Mason alone. But if he can't or won't take it, meaning he never owns it, then it goes to Jake. So you only have one person owning it through Eddie's will. That's fine. Hypo 65 gets a little trickier. Eddie gives his watch to his son Mason and says, if LSU beats Alabama, the watch is going to Jake. Is that a prohibited substitution? No. This is kind of along the lines of Batten. Both of these gifts, if you will, are subject to conditions. Okay, think about it. When Eddie gave the watch to Mason, he gave it to him, but he basically attached a resolutory condition to it. He said, if LSU beats Alabama, then I get the watch back and I'm going to give it to Jake. Jake's gift has a suspensive condition attached to it. He's only going to get the watch if LSU were to beat Alabama. So if LSU does beat Bama, then the condition on Mason's gift is resolved and the condition on Jake's gift is fulfilled. And so under principles of conditions that you learn in obligations, once the condition is fulfilled, it's as if Mason never actually owned the watch at all, and it is also considered as if Jake had been the owner all along. Now, if Alabama were to win, then neither condition is fulfilled on Jake or Mason's gift, and so you certainly don't have any worries there. But in either case, you only have one person owning that watch. You're not having one and then the other own it. Hypo 66 says this, Eddie's telling his sons Mason and Jake, if LSU defeats Alabama, I give my watch to Mason. If Alabama defeats LSU, I give my watch to Jake. Very similar. Is this a prohibited substitution? No. This is another double conditional gift. Both of them have suspensive conditions attached. So the ownership will only pass if a certain outcome comes between this football game between LSU and Bama. So if LSU wins, Mason gets the watch and is retroactively considered to have been the owner since Eddie made the statement. If Bama wins, Jake gets the watch, and he's considered retroactively to have been the owner since Eddie made the statement. But in either case, only one of them owns that watch. So that wraps up the second element. So prohibited substitution, first, not a trust. Second, double liberality. Third, you need to have, if you've got that double liberality, you need to have the first donee having to conserve the thing and then rendering it to the second donee. Now, when you say conserve the thing, what this means is you know, we're kind of going to, I don't know, we're assuming, I guess, that the donor intends for that first donee to keep the thing in his patrimony and not abuse it. Now, you're not going to like this, but that doesn't have to be expressly stated in the donation. A lot of courts have said, oh, we're just going to, we're going to implicitly read that in. We're going to believe that the donor tacitly wanted the first donee to conserve or preserve the object in question. The render part of that, so I say the first donee has a duty to conserve and then render the thing to the second donee. Render meaning, of course, the first donee has to turn it over. So basically, if I said, I leave my house to X, and upon his death, to Y. Well, in that situation, I didn't say you have to conserve it, but courts will read that in to mean that, yeah, the first donee, X, is going to get it for ownership, and then upon his death, he's got to turn around and give it, render it. The render's there. The conserve is just implicit. Now, if I said something like this, I give my house to X, and X can't sell the house for 10 years. Well, I mean, there's a duty to conserve the house for a certain term, but there's no duty in there to render it to somebody else. So you don't have the three people. You don't have to worry about it there. Now, of course, under succession vitale, which we discussed with regard to conditions, you might have a problem under the conditions article, but not under prohibited substitution. Something else you got to kind of be on the lookout for is something that is brought up in the succession of Johnson case. This is on page 13-18 of your book. In that case, you have a guy who died. His name is Thomas Johnson. He died testate. Now, Thomas did something a little bit crazy. He was married to this woman named Fern, and he and Fern had a son together named Robert. Well, Fern died, and then Thomas turned around and married Fern's sister named Sue. He and Sue had a kid together named Martha Jane. Well, now Thomas is dead, and in his will, he said, all right, I'm going to leave Sue, my second wife, everything as long as she lives, and then I want her to leave to my son Robert a quarter of what's left and leave to our daughter Martha Jane the rest of what's left. All right, so the court has to grapple with, all right, is that a prohibited substitution? More particularly, is there a duty to conserve and render? The court in that case said no. See, the words of Thomas's will said, I'm going to leave to Sue everything, as long as she shall live. And then when she dies, a quarter of what is left to Robert and the rest of what is left to Martha Jane. The court said this language, what is left, well, that sort of implicitly means that there might be nothing left. So there's no duty imposed on Sue to preserve anything for Robert and Martha Jane. So the property vested in Sue, Sue can do whatever she wants with that property. So that is not a prohibited substitution because there's no duty to conserve. I will point out one thing about Johnson. If you read that case carefully, there is something in there that is now incorrect law. It's not what we just talked about. But it's regarding the effect of a prohibited substitution, which I haven't told you yet. But that case said that if there's a prohibited substitution, the whole will would be invalid. That is no longer true under Louisiana law. I'll tell you the effect of a prohibited substitution in just a minute, but it does not invalidate the will. See succession of Walters, by the way, for proof of that. And so basically, that this business about leaving what's left, is not a prohibited substitution because it is not a duty to conserve imposed upon the first donee. Something else that pops up kind of along that line that you need to be aware of is something we call like a precatory legacy. A precatory legacy might say something to the effect of, I leave all my property to X. X, when you die, I would like for you to leave that property I left you to Y. Well, that is just a precatory legacy. It's kind of expressing the wishes of the decedent to, here's what I want you to do with it, but by its very terminology, it's kind of indicating that the decedent knows he can't impose his will like that on the first donee. And so the courts are going to say that's not a prohibited substitution. There was no duty imposed by the testator to the first donee to preserve and render it to the second donee. He's saying he wants him to, but he's not telling him he has to. And so that is perfectly fine. So looking at the hypotheticals, Hypo 68 says Ryan is an unmarried man. He has no kids. He makes out a testament directing his executor to liquidate his estate, place the proceeds in a bank account. Then in the testament, he says his sister will have a usufruct over all the money in the account and that she can take up $10,000 a month for her living expenses. And then he says that on Jasmine's death, anything left over goes to his nephew, Charlie. Well, Ryan dies, and they're dealing with the probate of the will, and basically the court has to figure out, or you have to figure out, is that a prohibited substitution? The answer is it's not. Ryan, of course, left Jasmine a usufruct over the account. He also basically has given her a $10,000 a month max allowance. And the account will go to Charlie when Jasmine dies, but he's not really giving the same thing in full ownership to two people. Remember, Jasmine just has a usufruct. So I guess right now Charlie would have naked ownership, and upon Jasmine's death, Charlie would then have full ownership. And it very well may be also, I mean, the main reason I have this hypothetical is that Jasmine has no duty to conserve anything. So it may very well be that there's nothing left. Maybe she takes out the $10,000 a month and expends it all before she dies, leaving nothing for Charlie. So there is no duty to conserve. Hypo 69 says Ryan leaves a will saying, I'll leave Jasmine everything for as long as she shall live. And on the condition that she leave to her son Charlie no more but no less than one quarter of what is left at the end of her life. So the deal is that a prohibited substitution? No. Again, it's like the last case we discussed. There is a duty to render here, but there's no duty to conserve. Jasmine can spend basically all of it if she wants because he uses the words what is left. Hypo 70, Ryan makes out a testament leaving all his property and says when she dies to Jasmine, and when she dies, I would really like it if she would leave the property to Charlie. Of course, that's not a prohibited substitution. There's no legal duty imposed on Jasmine to render the thing, so it's precatory. And then Hypo 71 says Ryan makes out a testament leaving the farm to his sister, subject to on her death that she transmits the farm to whomever she may choose. That's not a prohibited substitution. We don't have Ryan trying to say who gets it first and then second. He is imposing a duty on Jasmine to conserve the farm or preserve it, but not to render it to any particular person. So that would not be a prohibited substitution. All right, so again, prohibited substitution, first element, not a trust. Second, you need a double liberality. Third, you need a duty on the first donee to conserve and render. The final element to a prohibited substitution is you need successorial order. So what I mean by that is what triggers the transfer from the first donee to the second donee such to create a prohibited substitution is that the property is going from the first one to the second one on the first donee's death. If the decedent provides that it's going from the first donee to the second donee at some other point in time besides death, that's fine. You may have a time problem under Article 1521, but you're not going to have a prohibited substitution. And so one of the cases that I assign you guys to deal with that issue is the Morgan case. It's a Third Circuit opinion from 1972. It's on page 13-23, and in that case, Woodrow and Morgan died testate, and what he did, he basically left a piece of property, two pieces of property, in fact, to his wife, Evelyn. And for one of them, it basically was going to Evelyn and then to Johnny Morgan. And then the second one, it was going to Evelyn and then to Randy Dunn. And, you know, is this a prohibited substitution? Sure. In that case, the property would transfer from Evelyn to the second donee upon Evelyn's death in full ownership. And so, therefore, the whole provision is going to be null. We'll talk about that in just a second, but that is a prohibited substitution. Likewise, Hypo 72 deals with a similar scenario. It says, on the verge of death, Katie executes an act of donation in which she leaves her designer clothes collection to her sister Fran until such time as Katie's 5-year-old daughter, Suri, reaches majority, at which point Fran must deliver the clothes to Suri. Is this a prohibited substitution? No. The thing I'm trying to trigger there is that the passing of the clothes from Fran to Suri doesn't happen on the death of the first donee, Fran, so that would not be a prohibited substitution. Now, of course, this is problematic. You're taking the clothes out of commerce for 13 years, which is not allowable. So you might have a condition issue, but you don't have a prohibited substitution. So those are the four elements for a prohibited substitution. You need all four for it to be designated as such. Now, if you do have all four, what does that mean? Well, what that means is the entire donation is null. So it's basically like it's scratched out. And depending on the will in question, it may go somewhere else under the will. It may go intestate. We'll learn about all this later. But the main thing that you need to understand is that neither the first donee nor the second donee will get it through the provision in question. So the prohibited substitution is essentially just going to be scratched out. And again, it's not going to invalidate the entire will. It's just going to mean that that one provision is invalid. So that wraps up our discussion about limits on a donor's power. You know that he cannot violate forced heirship law. You know that he cannot place impossible, immoral, or illegal conditions on donations. And now you also know that his donation cannot be a prohibited substitution. So that wraps up our discussion. Again, this material will be tested on your third quiz and on your final exam, and you could probably expect to see it on the bar exam as well. So I hope you guys have a good evening, and I'll see you in our next class. Good night.